leaders.
We pose the problem to human beings in their relations with the world.
Change.
GP made this one right here. You know it's a hit.
Impact.
Liberation is a praxis of action to reflection upon the world.
Welcome to the pedagogy
Justice.
Of the obsessed.
Our chief want in life is somebody who will make us do what we can. These words from Ralph Waldo Emerson shed light on the nature of relationships in a profession like education. It is an idea Benjamin Disraeli advocated for, as the greatest good you can do for another is not just to share your riches, but to reveal him his own. This week, we are launching a series that looks at the role of mentoring in the education profession. To do so, we are going to follow the relationships and impact of educators who have inspired others. We start this journey by looking to our own mentors and tracing back the people who have influenced their work. What became apparent was how many of these leaders, both researchers and practitioners, found insight and guidance from one man, Dr. David Cohen. For me, and many of the mentors I spoke with, there is no greater thinker than David Cohen. In over 55 years as a scholar and activist, he has studied how schools might serve all students and what conditions are necessary for school systems to achieve that goal at scale. Along with Deborah Ball, David is best known as the originator of the concept of the instructional core. This work identifies the relationships between teachers, students, and content as necessary to considering any theoretical improvement in learning outcomes. In this interview, I asked David the same questions that I ask of those impacted through his mentorship in future episodes. We talk about his mentors, his approach to mentoring, and his advice for those who will do the work of mentoring. As you will learn from David, mentoring is the chain that connects us to the past and propels us into the future. It is, to paraphrase Isaac Newton, the opportunity to see further by standing on the shoulders of giants. I want to thank David for being a giant for so many, both through his relationships and the dissemination of his ideas about school. It says in Proverbs, iron sharpens iron, and one man sharpens another. I have no doubt our listeners will leave this conversation a bit sharper. I certainly did.
What's been your journey into the world of education?
It was a little complicated. My first school was a one-room school in what I later learned was Appalachia.
Okay.
One teacher, one room, one wood-burning stove, and maybe 8 or 10 kids in a small rural community in the Hudson River Valley. I went to another equally ungood elementary school and a not very good high school. I wound up in graduate school learning to become a European historian.
So how do you make the jump from ungood elementary and middle and high schools to graduate school?
Well, I grew up in rural America, and I went to pretty lousy schools. And I grew up with the rural proletariat, what some people refer to as poor white trash. And I did the things that those kids did. I hunted, I fished, I was a crack shot. I spent a lot of time in the woods. I spent no more time in school than I could because it was really boring. My ambition was to become a forest ranger because I loved the woods and I didn't like schools. My parents, who were both the children of immigrants, were scandalized and insisted that I go to college, not to the Syracuse School of Forestry, which I did grudgingly. And there I met other kids who had gone to the Bronx High School of Science, the High School of Music and Art, Stuyvesant High School, and other really classy schools, kids who really had learned stuff in high school, and I hadn't. But that stoked my appetite for learning. I dropped out of graduate school after my third semester. I was learning to be a European historian. It just seemed so academic, and I wanted something that was more socially engaged. So I went to New York, where all important things happened, and in 1958, there was no discernible socially engaged work. I looked. If I had been smarter, I could have found a couple of things, but I was completely uninformed. So I went back to graduate school, finished my degree, got a job at Case Western Reserve in Cleveland, teaching in a history of science and technology program. One day in March or April of 63, I was walking across campus to get coffee with a colleague and friend of mine. And we stopped to get our copies of the New York Times. And there on the front page of the paper was that picture of Bull Connor's dogs and hoses and the kids in Birmingham. And I said, holy mackerel. And Dan, my colleague, said, you can't do anything about that. And I said to myself, if you can't do something about that, you better might as well hang it up. And that evening on the way home, the local FM station did a public service announcement about the formation of a local chapter of the Congress of Racial Equality. I went. Mm-hmm. And I then spent the next, I don't know, 6 or 7 years working more or less full-time in the civil rights movement.
And what did your parents think of that move? Was it better than the forestry?
Well, I didn't consult them. It's a good question, Adam. I'm not sure what they thought. They didn't object. It completely changed my life.
And why do you think it was so salient for you?
Partly it was that I had dropped out of graduate school several years before, looking for exactly what found me in the spring of 1963. So it connected with something that was already active in my mind. But also, it was just very, very clear that this was a battle for the soul of the country. I had been living in Paris doing the research for my dissertation when the lunch counter sit-ins happened. And I remember reading the International Herald Trib and seeing those pictures, reading the stories, and thinking, I got to get back there. I got to be part of this. History served up an opportunity for me to do things that I had wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And so I plunged in. It was quite literally a life-changing experience. Because the movement in Cleveland coalesced around education, I got involved with public education in ways that I had never expected to. The local chapter of the Congress of Racial Equality spent a lot of time organizing on the black, on the east side of Cleveland. The most persistent thing we heard from families was the ways in which the system had organized to shortchange black families and black kids. When the direct action movement began to play itself out in 64, early 65, one of the things we had heard was that the system had gerrymandered elementary school boundaries to contain the black population in black school, to protect whites from African Americans. I thought, okay, I'll check this out. And I put on a sport coat and a tie and went to the Board of Education building and said that I was an academic studying population movements and was looking for data on population. Did they have any? And I wound up in the Bureau of Attendance, which had records for every elementary school in the system of every school district boundary change for every year, beginning with 1916. I asked if I could copy them, and I did. And then I got the local council of churches to give me some money to hire an assistant, and I got the local chapter of the NAA to give me an office. And I plotted those school by school, year by year boundary changes against census data, census block data, and was able to show that they had done exactly what people in the community had said. And I was doing the work, and a friend of mine from the movement who was an attorney and was on the board of the local branch just came by for some other reason, saw me and said, what are you doing? And I told him. He said, let me look at that. And he then called Robert Carter, who was the general counsel nationally of the NAA. And Carter had, Bob had argued the Brown cases with Thurgood Marshall. Actually, he was first up in the Supreme Court when those cases were argued in 53. And he was looking for Northern cases and flew out to Cleveland and spent the better part of the day with me going over the data. And he said, we've got a school suit. And I spent the next year or two working with Bob, putting that suit together, and then going elsewhere to dig up similar data from other systems. I became an education researcher. And then in the fall of 65, the administration in Washington was enforcing Title VI of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which prohibited the use of federal funds in segregated facilities. And this was having a huge effect in the South, in hospitals, in schools, in even in universities. Lyndon Johnson's former colleagues in the Senate were on him about, you know, why are you just doing this to us? What about those people in the North? They do the same thing. The president asked the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights to do a study of Northern school segregation. The staff director of the commission had worked for Bob Carter, and so he called Bob and said, do you know anybody who knows anything about Northern school segregation? And there really weren't very many people, so Bob suggested me. And I went to work for the commission directing the study of Northern school segregation. By the time the study was done, I knew what I should have known coming in. One of our advisors was Tom Pettigrew, who was a professor of social psychology here. Tom had been one of Gordon Allport's students. And at that point in the 60s, 65, 66, 67, Tom was probably the only white professor at a major research university who was teaching about race. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are plenty of African Americans at the historically black colleges and universities, but it was not a topic. Tom was one of our most important advisors in doing the civil rights study, and he asked me, what are you going to do afterwards? And I knew I didn't want to continue working for the government, because if you work for the government and your supervisor tells you do X, you have to do X.
Yeah.
And I was enough of an academic already to feel as though that was an inappropriate infringement. But I didn't want to go back to teaching the history of ideas to undergraduates. That had been a very unsatisfying experience. And he said, well, why don't you apply for a Social Science Research Council postdoc and come to Harvard? Well, I had gone to lousy schools and a second-rate university, and I thought, I'll never get to Harvard. But Tom insisted, and sure enough, I got a postdoc and came here and spent a year at the Harvard-MIT Joint Center for Urban Studies, and one thing led to another, and I wound up teaching at the HGSE.
You shared about a couple of people there. Your path was headed one way, and through the right kind of nudging, took it in directions that you had never even thought or considered.
Right.
As you think about these mentors, are there other stories or other mentors that have really shaped your work, either in these formative stages or during other, you know, decision points in your career?
Bob Carter was very influential. He was one of the leading civil rights attorneys in the country. As I said, he had argued the Brown cases with Thurgood. He was part of a black intelligence, New York intelligentsia. Kenneth Clark was one of Bob's friends. I mean, Ken had been a witness in the Brown cases. And Hyland Lewis, a very distinguished anthropologist, was also a friend of Bob's, Ralph Ellison. So these guys, and they were guys, were the brightest lights in the African-American community. And I got to know them through Bob. Kenneth made me a fellow of his research center.
Tell me more about your relationship with Bob. And one of the things I'm curious about is like how these mentoring relationships kind of change over time.
Well, Bob had two boys. Mm-hmm. Derek Bell, who was a professor here at the law school, mm-hmm. and me. Mm-hmm. And it was a sort of a thing in black America to have people who you sponsored. I don't think Bob would have used the term mentor, mm-hmm. because what he did was a combination of education and guidance and clear opening paths, making connections that I would not have been able to make by myself. The direct action movement, North and South, was burning itself out. The anti-war movement was thriving. And I was thinking that I really would go to work as a community organizer, trying to promote political action in poor communities. And then this Washington job came up. And I'd been working with Bob in Cincinnati and Milwaukee and other places. So we saw quite a lot of each other. And he was a very bright, very elegant, restrained man. He wasn't like Thurgood Marshall. He wasn't, you didn't get a blast. So I told him what I was thinking about. And he said, in effect, he said, David, now you have all this knowledge and all these skills. I'm sure you could be a good community organizer, but you could do a lot more good for the movement, putting those skills to work for us. So for heaven's sake, take the Washington job. So I did. And it was a very significant thing to have done. I mean, it was very difficult, but it introduced me to Tom Pettigrew. He taught me a lot of things, but he wanted me to work for him because I knew things and could do things that he couldn't do. It was a pretty balanced relationship. One of the most important parts of it was he believed in me, which never hurts.
Was it that he also believed in you in times when you didn't believe in yourself, or was it reconfirming like the sense of, I think I can do this, and it put you over the top?
Well, memory is one of the most slippery human faculties. I think it was some combination of those things, Adam. I was seriously considering the Civil Rights Commission job. I didn't know enough to be appropriately intimidated by what I would have to do. And Bob didn't either. He just had a sense of the sorts of work that someone like me should do. And, you know, he wanted one of his boys in a place of influence. Mm-hmm. He urged Derek very, very strongly to come to HLS when Derek had many, many hesitations about coming. So it was partly a matter of him promoting his boys.
You've obviously gone from being mentored and being noticed to being someone who's been able to perform that same function for others. And so when you think about that role, that responsibility that comes with doing the work, what's your approach to mentorship?
Cautious. No, I am cautious because it's people's lives, their careers. And as you know better than I, the work for which you all are preparing is very chancy. And it depends on lots of things that you can never control. I tend to be cautious. I spent some time on the phone this morning with a former student at the University of Michigan, a very, very bright guy, who finished his dissertation 5 or 6 months ago, did a very nice job, and is now working for a private foundation that has been promoting Montessori in the public sector, which I think is a really interesting effort. And he was asking me, what did I think his next move should be? So my response to his question was to ask him what if resources and all the usual constraints could be suspended, what would he do? I answered his question with a question, and he thought about it for a couple of minutes and said, well, he thought that what he would like to do most of all is to invent and implement interventions that would improve schools for African American kids. He served up part of the answer to his question to me, and then we talked about what the alternatives might be. I was able to help him think about what the alternatives were, but to do so within a territory that he defined. You know, when you told me you were going to go back to Chicago and work in schools and become a principal and so on and so forth, I restrained myself from making any observations about the craziness of work in Chicago, thinking partly you knew much more about that than I did anyway, and you would have taken that into account. Anybody who winds up in a place like this is plenty smart enough to have figured out a lot about what they want to do and why, and what they don't want to do and why.
So mostly questions, mostly invitation, yeah. Mostly connection.
Yeah. One thing I said to my friend from the U of M was that I had just been reading Charles Payne's book, mm-hmm. So Much Reform, So yep. Little Change. It's a really good book.
It is a good book.
Payne is a very, very wise as well as and a smart guy.
We got him in Chicago for a good 6 months. That was a nice era.
I told my former student that one of the things that Payne does in the book that really caught my attention, because I had been thinking about exactly that, is that he keeps coming back to the notion of why isn't there the equivalent of a Catholic school system for African Americans? And I've been thinking about this for several years now. If that had existed for the last 50 years, mm-hmm. we'd be in a very different place in this country. So I mentioned it to Blake, my former student, and he got it immediately because it was right in his sweet spot. And so he's going to think about how he might work on something like that.
And has there ever been a time in these relationships where you have thrown a little bit of caution to the wind and said something like, I don't know if that's a good idea?
Several of your predecessors in the program have gone to work in unusually dysfunctional school systems for their residency. Mm-hmm. And as they were negotiating this, I did ask some questions to try to learn how much they understood about what they were getting themselves into. But no, I never said. I mean, I would be disinclined to say something like that, Adam, unless it was clear to me that they really had a choice. As it turned out, in both of those cases, it was a hellish experience. It really was.
And as you think back to the people that you've mentored, are there regrets? Are there missteps that surfaced for you that were very edifying for your own learning?
A lot of the people that I've taught or worked with have gone on to research careers. And one of the things that has impressed me hugely is that in almost every case, they had to recover from the experience of being a graduate student to find their own voice, which in every case was really different from what they did in graduate school. And that has alerted me to the perils of being a teacher, the limitations of being a teacher, because I'm sure you've noticed this yourself. For the most part, people who wind up in places like this, really good universities, have learned how to do school. Mm-hmm. That's why they're here. They've racked up good academic records. But learning how to do school typically does not include learning how to be original, learning how to do things that are at 90 or 180 degrees from what the mission of the school is, et cetera, et cetera. That's a real limitation. It makes it really difficult for graduate students who are looking toward a professional career to break step and to try to do something that nobody is inviting them to do. I've been much more cautious about involving students in my work and much more aggressive about encouraging them to follow their own light, because graduate school shouldn't be something that people have to recover from in order to have a career.
I would be under the impression, from what I've read, that most people who are talking about instruction at a high level and what's going on in classrooms have you as a reference somewhere in the back of their work. What's probably the most surprising reinterpretation or use of your work and your thinking that you've seen? And what have you found to be the most exciting use of it?
People say that I've had students, and I truly don't see it that way. These are people I've worked with, and I've learned as much from them, I think, as they have learned from me. And my closest collaborators now are people who were my students. But we didn't have that kind of relationship. And they're much smarter about a lot of things than I am. Two of my former doctoral advisees, Jim Spillan and Don Purak, and I are doing a big comparative study of school systems within the U.S., mm-hmm. comparing IB, Montessori, Catholic schools, and a charter system and a couple of public systems. And working with them is a joy because they're so much better at so many parts of this than I am. It isn't that there's, you know, an occasional time when people revise my ideas. It's much more like learning together, which is what keeps it inviting.
As you think about others who are responsible for handing off the work, for finding people and mentoring and passing the torch, what advice do you have for them?
People work differently depending on the sort of person they are. And Andres, who I admire endlessly, is very direct, blunt, and in best Andres fashion, he doesn't pull his punches. And I'm much more reticent than Andres, just as a human being. One piece of advice would be understand yourself and what sort of advice you're capable of giving. And the other is understand the world that people are going into. I think one of the most interesting and possibly promising things that's happening in your city is what seems to be the development of a K-12 IB system within Chicago. Now, that could be really promising, because these districts don't have, as you know, they don't have what it takes to do the work they're supposed to do. I think one part of what's happening in Chicago is a recognition of that and trying to find systems like IB that have the wherewithal to do the sorts of work that a big city system should be doing on its own. If we had just met and you were not from Chicago, and I would talk with you about that. The International Baccalaureate could be revised to work for disadvantaged kids in big cities. That would be a huge breakthrough. Mm-hmm. And it's not the sort of thing that a big city system can do. They don't have the infrastructure. They don't have the curriculum. They don't have the professional education. They don't have the supervision. That these systems were not built to do those things.
What advice do you have for those who are doing the work of improving schools?
One reason I love teaching this class that you took is that I think the EDLDs are the sorts of students that ed schools should always have had and rarely have. I mean, you guys are, in my view, the ideal professional school student. You're people who've done something consequential, who are really intelligent, and who are going to go back and do more. And for that reason, you're really different from research students and much more challenging to work with. The question is not, is this interesting? The question is this going to help me do the work? Which is exactly the right professional school question. But because these ed schools live in the shadow of the faculties of arts and sciences, most of the faculty in the ed schools don't get that. They see themselves as, you know, sociologists, political scientists, and so on. The thing that I think about a lot, the course walks a kind of tightrope between hope and despair, because every one of you has been there and knows at least some of the deepest problems. And that knowledge is adequate grounds for despair. These systems are broken in some really fundamental ways. Improving schools, especially for disadvantaged kids, is the most important work that people can do. I try to walk that line and to encourage a realistic sense of what's possible, what's hopeful, but not to do so in ways that are ridiculous. It's a struggle. It really is, because there are so many things wrong with the country and with the systems that exist in it, and so many reasons to want to fix it.
We pose the problems of human beings in their relations with the world. Knowledge emerges only through invention and reinvention, through the restless and patient continuing, hopeful inquiry human beings pursue in the world, and with each other. The solution is not to integrate them into the structure of oppression, but to transform that structure so that they become beings for themselves. Liberation is a praxis of action and reflection on the world.